You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues. It's a great day for Brookings to host the Managing Director, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, just at the beginning of the spring meetings and also of the G20 parallel meetings. The event is even better, even greater, because Sharon Burrows, the head of the International Trade Union Confederation, is also here joining in with Dominik Strauss-Kahn. I think it's a special message. And we're very lucky also to have Professor George Akerlof and Stephen Percy, senior advisor to the head of the ILO. Professor Akerlof also doesn't need any introductions. Nobel Prize winner 2001 for his analysis of the impact on markets of asymmetric information. He is a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings also and a professor at Berkeley. Stephen Percy has been in the international and national trade union movement. He is the senior advisor to the ILO now on cooperation with the IMF and on the macroeconomic implications of labor market and employment issues in particular. Sharon, a great leader, a teacher at the beginning of her life, a leader of women in the trade union movement, and now heading an organization that represents about 170 million workers worldwide in 150 different countries. And of course, the managing director, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, doesn't need any additional words. I think I want to just remind you that he's also a professor of economics. And of course, he was minister of finance in France. And I think he's led the IMF at this very critical moment in these last 2-3 years in a really remarkable fashion. The institution, which was always a strong institution, but it has been transformed. And I think he, in many speeches, has reminded us that there cannot be macroeconomic, long-term macroeconomic stability and sustainability without strength in the labor market, without employment, and without greater equity. Let me just say one word about the employment issue. I think it is, of course, a moral and ethical, a political issue. It's a political priority across the world. I think a job is not just an income, but it's also human dignity, it's participation in society. It has impact on health, on family. There's evidence, as was presented at the joint meeting of the IMF and the ILO in Oslo, on the health of children, on long-term income and health issues for the family. It's a major ethical, moral challenge to provide full employment across the world. But I think there's also another angle now, and the IMF is beginning to do some very interesting research. It may also be very much linked to dynamics of income distribution, which themselves are linked to macroeconomic policy effectiveness. There are now, I think, views that the extreme concentration of income at the top and the imbalance, the fact that the middle class is not sharing in the growth of productivity, is not just a political and ethical problem, but is also a problem for sustainable, effective demand. So I think we may touch on these issues also today, but I don't want to take more time and invite the Managing Director, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, to take the floor now. Many thanks, Dominik, for being here.
Well, good morning, and I want to thank the Brookings Institution for... No, I got it. Thank you. Don't worry. The problem is that I don't use the written speech because last time I did it was so long that people tell me, it was so boring, why did you have such a long speech? And I ask my staff, why did you write for me such a long speech? And they say, well, sir, it wasn't so long, but there was no need to read it twice. So I prefer to keep this away. So I want to thank the Brookings Institution and my good friend Kemal Davis for having organized this very important and hosting this very important and timely event. And I'm especially glad that Sharon Burrow, the General Secretary of ITEC, will be with us this morning together with George and Steve. Just let me start with a quotation. At the end of this magnum opus, The General Theory, Keynes stated the following. The outstanding folds of the economic society in which we live are its failure to provide for full employment and its arbitrary and inequitable distribution of wealth and incomes. I think that not everyone will agree with the entirety of this statement, but we have learned that unemployment and inequalities can undermine the achievements of the market economy, and therefore sowing the seeds for instability and crisis. And when we look how dangerous this cocktail of unemployment and inequality can be, was also associated with some political tension, when we can see how it's playing out in the Middle East and North Africa. And of course, this is an easy example, a timely example, but also a real example, which shows that when you look only at the traditional macroeconomic figures that the IMF usually do, you may have a look of a country saying, fine, growth is not bad, inflation is low, current account is fine, deficit are not very big. So have a rather positive assessment of a country, which from one point of view is totally wrong, just because we don't look enough at what's happening within the country. And that's a very important point I'm making for weeks now, which is that this recovery is unequal and uneven, but not only between countries, but also within countries. Because growth beset by social tension is not conducive to economic and financial stability, we in the IMF, we cannot be indifferent to distribution issues. And that's a very strong point for me. As Kemal just said, there are maybe a lot of ethical reasons why people would be interested in inequalities, income distribution, all this kind of thing. And I did spend myself, when I was a student, a lot of time on this. But that's not the point, or at least that's not the only point, not the main point for the IMF. The main point for the IMF is that we are in charge of providing, or at least helping to provide, some kind of economic stability. And so each and every topic that may undermine economic stability is one of our concerns. And frankly, when I look around today, there are reasons to be concerned. For the recovery is here, but growth, at least in advanced economies, is not creating enough jobs. And clearly, it's not the recovery we want. Many people in many countries are facing social crisis that is every bit as serious as the financial crisis. No need to remind you that unemployment is at record levels in many countries. The crisis threw 30 million people out of work, and more than 200 million people around the world looking for jobs. And one point which is very important in terms of stability and possibility of social and political unrest, also, of course, on the ethical side, is that the job crisis is hitting the young especially hard. What should have been a brief spell in unemployment is turning into a life sentence, and we are facing really the risk of a lost generation. So when you look at this, unemployment on one hand, and on the other hand, the fact that in too many countries inequalities is at record highs, there's a thing to worry about the sustainability of growth in these countries. At the same time, as we face these challenges, we have to remember what has been accomplished during the last years under the umbrella of the G20. Policymakers came together. I have made this point several times. I don't want to elaborate too much. But I think we shouldn't forget the remarkable cooperation that took place in 2009 and at least the first half of 2010, really avoiding for the global economy something which could have been a collapse as big as the Great Depression. I'm not saying we didn't have a crisis. Of course, we had a crisis. We're still in the aftermath of the crisis. But the huge crisis that it could have been has been so far avoided. Okay, we have been able to do that. We have been able to cooperate. We have been able to put everybody together looking in the same direction and try to do the right thing. So today, we need a similar full force forward response to get the recovery we need, which is a recovery which take into account more than it does so far the question of unemployment. So it means not only a sustainable recovery, but also one that brings employment and fair distribution. Let me start a few words about employment. Just as we managed to tame inflation in the 80s, this decade should be the decade of employment. What must be done for this? We all know what has to be done. It's politically difficult, it's costly, but we know what is on the agenda. We need to go on repairing and reforming the financial sector to put the banks at the service of the real economy. We need direct credit to SMEs, which are the key drivers of employment. While employment is so high and rather few inflationary pressure, monetary policy can go on being supportive. And what about fiscal policy? That's the most difficult point, because in many, not to say in all advanced economies, the question of medium-term fiscal consolidation is really an important question, including in this country, but also in European countries, most of them, not only the one which are at the edge of the cliff, but all of them. At the same time, we all know that fiscal consolidation, even in the medium term, may have some impact on growth. So the trade-off is difficult, has to be handled very carefully, and it really has to be looked at country by country on a case-to-case basis. But another side of the coin is that, of course, growth alone is not enough. And what we have learned altogether is that well-designed labor market policy may help to create job. And that's probably the worst news of this recovery, that we may have a recovery, and we have a recovery. It's still underway, but without the job that were expected when in the traditional models we were associating 1 point of growth to X millions of jobs across the world. Then comes the question of, fine, unemployment is at very high level and it's not going to decrease as quickly as we wish, so what about unemployment benefits? And I think that few would disagree that the decent unemployment benefits are foundational. Especially, it's relevant when job losses are heavily concentrated among the young or the unskilled. But, of course, we must be pragmatic. And what I think is that really we need to get past the binary and a helpful contrast between flexibility and rigidity in labor market. What we have to do is to ask ourselves, which are the effective policy? Which are the policy that are likely to create jobs? Sometimes they are, sometimes they are not. I'm not that much interested in if they call it flexible policy or they call it rigid policy. That's not the point. The point is what is the end result and how able we are to define policy that will really use growth to create job. Now let me say, talk briefly about the second lung of the social crisis, namely inequality. IMF research suggests that inequality can make countries more prone to financial crisis. We have some very interesting result on this. At the same time, some other IMF research shows that the sustainable growth over time is associated with more equal income distribution. And these challenges, interestingly enough, affect both advanced economies and developing countries. So it's not only a question for traditional advanced economy having this kind of trade-off, it's also true in most developing countries. So there's no ambiguity. We need policy to reduce inequality and to ensure a fairer distribution of opportunity and resources. We need strong social safety net combined with progressive taxation that can dampen market-driven inequalities. We need more investment in health and educational. We need collective bargaining that is very important, especially in an environment of stagnation of real wages. And we need social partnership, which is a useful framework, as it allows fair sharing of both the gains and the pains. Again, we can need this because it's our view of the society. That's philosophical posture. From the IMF point of view, that's not the point. We need it because it's a condition to the sustainability of growth. So let me say a few words about the role of the IMF. As we do understand the links with stability better, the job issues is becoming more central to our surveillance, as the recent video that has been presented by Olivier Blanchard on Monday has shown. I have already mentioned some of our research result on inequalities, but as some of you may remember, we have also supported a taxation of some kind of financial activities, and we are paying more attention to the social dimension of our programs. I'm not trying to say that our program are social program, far from that, and they're always very painful for the countries being in trouble. But not only at the margin, you can take more into account or less into account the social problems and the situation of the most vulnerable in the countries. So we're trying to protect the social safety net when they exist, to build them where they don't exist, and support a more equitable sharing of the burden. Last year, we had, in September, a conference in Oslo, together with the ILO and the Norwegian government. And really, I think it was an important milestone following up now in several areas. We follow up with the ILO to better understand the policy behind the job-creating growth. We are following up with the ILO and in consultation with ITAC in supporting social partnership consultation between labor, employers, and government in three countries, namely Bulgaria, Zambia, and tomorrow the Dominican Republic. And we're also working with the ILO towards building more effective social protection floors in the low-income countries. This weekend is a busy weekend for the IMF. We will have the spring meetings where all finance ministers and governors of the world are supposed to gather. And my intent is not only to present them the picture of the recovery, which is a traditional role of the IMF, but also to remind the ministers and governors of what is behind the numbers, namely that too many people have still not seen the fruits of this growth. So let me conclude. A few thousand years ago, Aristotle wrote that the best partnership in the state is the one which operates through the middle people. Those states where the middle element is large, have every chance of having a well-run constitution, he said. That was true at the time of Aristotle, it was true at the time of Keynes, it's true today. Stability depends a lot on a strong middle class that can propel demand. And we will not see this if growth does not lead to decent jobs. So we will not see this if growth rewards the favored few over the marginalized many. So that's really what is at stake today. Recovery is there, not strong enough, but persistent. We have good hope that it will go on. But the question is, what is the distribution effect of this growth? And that's a real point on which we need to emphasize. Ultimately, employment and equity are building blocks of economic stability, of prosperity, and also building blocks of political stability and, at the end, of peace. On many occasions, I remind this, that the mandate of the IMF, as it has been defined 60 years, more than 60 years ago in 1944 in Bretton Woods, was a mandate where all the founding fathers had in mind that the ultimate goal was peace, because economic instability leads to social unrest, to political troubles, as the 30s have shown. So, of course, the effective mandate of the IMF is more limited and has to do with economic and financial stability. But what is the background?
the background is to be part of some of the many institutions that try to promote peace and in the world. So that's why all what I say this morning goes to the heart of the IMF mandate, and the problem we have to face these days is that it must also be put at the heart of today's political agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dominique. And let me just stress two messages. One is the equity and employment issues I mentioned. So labor market employment as well is one topic, but income distribution equity goes with it. And second, whatever our philosophical, political, ethical approaches are, it is also an issue of macroeconomics, and I think this is very important. So now we have the leader of the World Trade Unions, the number one leader of the trade unions in the world. Sharon, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. I think Dominic hasn't left much room, really, so there's going to be a strange but repetitive piece of discourse here. But, Mr. Managing Director, ladies and gentlemen, first let me bring you greetings on behalf of the 175 million workers organised worldwide in the International Trade Union Confederation. Colonel Dervis, allow me to thank you for the opportunity to address this timely discussion organised by the Brookings Institution. Now, I would like to begin by paying tribute to the leadership of the IMF, Mr. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, and ask all government leaders to reflect on his call to action around unemployment and inequity. It's just over 3 years since Dominic first warned at Davos that the world stood on the brink of a precipice of accelerating recession, unemployment and instability. Sadly, his call for action was not heeded before the world economy had fallen into a steep decline from which it is now only starting to emerge feebly and with significant risk of resuming its downward slide and with increased unemployment and inequity. This is a bleak and uneven financial and social picture without factoring in the tragedy of natural disasters, particularly in Japan. The greatest risk now is the unresolved crisis of unemployment and inequity. I couldn't have said it better than Dominic himself. Unemployment stands at currently around 205 million worldwide, its highest ever on recorded levels, and yet even that is a significant underestimate of its true depth, since many millions of people seeking work, particularly women, are not registered, and the informal economy is growing in every country, as it struggles to accommodate those people seeking a desperate livelihood. It's a worsening long-term problem too, with some 45 million young people joining the labour market every year, many increasingly desperate for opportunity, as we've seen in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen and neighbouring countries. But also look to Spain, Ireland, the US, Africa, America, Asia, pick a country. Youth unemployment is a global fear for our young people who risk finding a jobs market with no vacancies for them. G20 leaders seem to have turned their back on this problem, and we ask them to take another look. In London and Pittsburgh in 2009, the leaders and their finance ministers appeared to clearly understand the vital role that employment played in ensuring recovery, not just to mitigate social costs and prevent an explosion of anger from workers, indeed the anger you're seeing from young people now, but because wages actually constitute the basis for a stable and shared consumption-based recovery, and not the return of the inequitable and misery-creating boom-and-bust economies that we knew before the crisis. The vulnerability, the very vulnerability that led to the greed of the financial sector-driven crisis. However, I must say, by Toronto and again in Seoul, we had to fight just to get the reference to quality jobs back into commitments. And yet, with no serious action on jobs to date, certainly no coordinated global action, not even a jobs target to mirror growth targets, when the G20 ministers met last week in Paris, a few weeks ago in Paris, in February, the paucity of reference to jobs in their final declaration provided even further evidence of that failure of comprehensive action. Of greatest significance was that they omitted jobs from their indicators of external imbalances, even though clearly employment is the major element of the aggregate demand that determines economic growth prospects and so inevitably is more than anything else the ultimate factor influencing external imbalances. The G20 2011 must mark the defining moment that things start to change, or otherwise the world will simply see just another failure in global governance. With too little action on financial regulation, the bankers are back in control and they're sucking public funds, the taxes of working people dry, as they demand bailouts still, while in turn demanding public sector jobs and fiscal austerity to satisfy the short-term profiteers of their bond market cousins, driven by the same ratings agencies who got it so wrong before the crisis. We must go beyond merely reacting to the short-term expediencies created by the crisis and look to coordinated employment and social protection plans as the basis for productivity, growth and fiscal consolidation. As Dominic said at the unprecedented conference organised by the IMF and the ILO in Oslo, both leaders, one Somerville and Dominic Strauss-Kahn, agreed that the world needed leadership on the fundamentals of an income-led recovery, quality employment and a social protection floor. Workers and their families are looking to them to construct the evidence, detail the costs and advocate the strategies to advise governments of a better and indeed a sustainable pathway to growth. The world needs a new growth model, and you'll see trade union leaders talking about this here with the ITUC and TUAC this week. Our leaders must decide now that they will support a global social protection floor and provide kickstart funding for the poorest countries, a global fund to both lift people out of poverty and establish a demand floor. They must decide now that they will restructure our economies to create the green jobs that can achieve the low-carbon economy that the planet needs. And they must decide now that they will prevent the levels of inequity that allowed the crisis to fester and explode. This requires wealth distribution mechanisms that ensure affordable finance for the real economy, a minimum wage on which working people can live, and good faith collective bargaining. Trade unions are already there. Just last week we called for an employment youth pact at the preparatory meeting of the Labor ministers of the G20. And indeed, we know that we're willing to be partners in global coherence. We need to promote a society in which workers' representatives, trade unions, can ensure that workers are protected and that the benefits of growth are shared equitably amongst all people, closing the divides that have opened up in too many countries between young and old, rural and urban, insiders and outsiders, women and men. In short, we need a wholesale structural regeneration of our economies, a new vision for growth supported by genuine social dialogue with the actors in the real economy, workers and employers. But will we see the necessary leadership from the G20? That's the question for 2011. It was again Dominic Strauss-Kahn that argued that the added value of coordinated stimulus measures at the height of the crisis was essential. These measures staved off the worst of the financial crisis, bailed out the banks, and with the support of trade unions, secured a future for many enterprises. Today, the message is the same, with the same urgency. Courageous, coordinated leadership, globally with employment targets, real action on jobs and social protection. This requires the G20 ministers to recognise the urgency when they meet here this week, and likewise the support of all IMF member countries when they meet in the days to come. The IMF, working with the ILO and other IFIs, can play a significant role if government leaders are serious about these two priorities. As a start, we need to return to the recognition in London and Pittsburgh and in the far-sighted G20 Labor ministers' conclusions held right here in Washington last year. We need to see those initiatives implemented. We need to see employment targets. We're going to look for employment targets to be incorporated into national economic programs and unemployment and social protection measures, including amongst the indicators of risk for peer review processes under the G20 mutual assessment process. And we ask the IMF to fully involve the ILO in providing analysis of employment and social protection in that mutual assessment process. Can I say that summary, because you can read the rest online, but in regard to the IMF, we do welcome the start that's been made with the ILO and the ITUC, and we hope the employers now in the three countries that Dominic talked about, Bulgaria, Zambia, and Dominican Republic, we hope. We know that you have to drive a new model based on credibility of real action at the local level. We need global coordination, but we need national action and support from all of the players in that regard. I've already indicated we need to see progress on global social protection, and the Bachelet panel will actually report in September alongside the work of the IMF and the ILO, and we need the G20 leaders and the UN Sustainability Panel in the lead-up to Rio to take note and support, in fact, the funds that actually will drive that for the poorest countries globally. A social protection floor is fully within our means. We need to raise unorthodox global funds. ODA is not working. It will not work when it's subject to the vulnerabilities of economies and to favouritism of bilateral arrangements. It can play a role, but we need to be much more strategic. I would just say a word about taxation. We know that the financial sector has not made a contribution, either to pay for the crisis that they created in part or indeed to look to the future. They're still and increasingly divorced with speculative activity from the real economy, and it's really hurting people on a range of fronts, not just jobs, not just insecurity, but indeed food prices and the like. Dominic, I know that you agree with me that the financial sector needs to provide a much greater contribution to match the cost it imposes each time it triggers a crisis in the productive economy. There is a growing political momentum in favour of a financial transactions tax. I would say that we should not be divided, as Dominic has called, by orthodoxy of the mechanics, but rather get the commitment to make this work. We also want to see, of course, a taxation arrangement globally around industrial sectors, where for little impost, sectors like transport and others can contribute to the global funds that will be necessary. And, of course, likewise, a price on carbon is inevitable. I don't want to dwell in this country where it seems that you contain the bulk of climate deniers at all level on this question, but governments must find a political courage to ensure the shift to a green economy. And again, it must be coordinated globally, hopefully with a UN binding agreement. But the opportunity is what we want people to focus on. Our calculations show you can have an increase in employment between 5 and 15% in every country within 15 to 20 years if the investment is there. And later on this year, we're doing the work and we will release a green jobs target for many of the economies in the world. In a few weeks' time, there'll be a key meetings, one on coherence, another at the ministerial level at the OECD, and the G8 summit in Deauville. These messages, the messages here today, that rights are social as well as economic tools. They're clearly social rights, but they're economic tools for wealth distribution. Aristotle got it right then, Dominic, and it's right now. And indeed, we want to see the investment in those other areas of the productive economy that drives jobs, value-added industries, the green economy, public services and infrastructure. Under your direction, Dominic, the IMF has begun, we think, for the first time to work significantly with the ILO in a way that supports the translation of such coherence from the national to the international level as well. But it's also become a voice for cutting through the timidity and the lack of courage that our governments show. So we will be making a full contribution to the meetings throughout the year, particularly beginning with the meeting on coherence, vital if we're to see our ambitions collectively achieved. The joined-up multilateral architecture with decent workers its underpinning that can correspond to the challenges of the globalised world for the 21st century is now an essential challenge. So, Dominic, we appreciate your remarks today and the leadership they portray and hope to work with you to bring that about. For us, it is imperative that jobs, decent work, social protection and the environment get the focus they deserve, a new growth model. Frankly, workers of the world won't settle for less. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon, for this very eloquent call for action, and I think the symbolism of the labor movement and the IMF exchanging views, maybe not agreeing on everything, but working together with the ILO as the tripartite organization also in the background is quite special and quite unique, I think. Professor Akilov, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for being here. It's nice to be back at Brookings, always. So I'm going to make 2 points. The first is motivated by a graph. Let's see whether we can get that graph. That's the graph. I don't know whether you can see it. Can you see it? It's over there. Oh, it's there. There, too. Oh, I can see it now. Okay. So that's the graph. If you can see it, you know, it's unemployment 27 weeks or over as a fraction of total unemployment in the United States. And if you look on the left, what you see is the foothills. You know, you go up and down and up and down. And then at the end, on the right-hand side, what you see is Mount Everest. So you don't see that usually in unemployment statistics. That I've never seen anything like this. And you can see that nothing like what has happened in recent history. It hasn't happened even in the history of the unemployment statistics. You'd have to go back to the 1930s when I couldn't have plotted this graph. So that takes us to the need for continued stimulus. The extreme shortage of jobs, I think we have to look at this in human terms. What it does, it makes life simply hell for the people who are unemployed. So this isn't just a graph. This constitutes millions of people. This is for the United States. I did it for the United States because I'm most familiar with that. Different labor markets, you'll have to look for the same statistics. Now, what happens here? Why is it hell? It's because there are very few job openings since there are very few quits. And then the odds of acceptance for any single job application, even for these very few openings that people can apply for, they're close to zero because then you're swamped by all the other many people who are applying at the same time. So this means that my first point is the continued stimulus to increase the number of available jobs is a first priority. When I look at how the economy is doing, I never look at the GDP statistics. I always look at the unemployment statistics and then the employment statistics. That's the way I measure it. And that corresponds to what Dominique Strauss-Kahn said at the beginning of his talk. This is a question of human dignity. The people can have the jobs that support to support themselves and their family and to have jobs with meaningful work. Okay, so now I'm going to come to a second point, and that concerns financial collapse. So a handful of world financial leaders in the fall of 2008, in the winter of 2009, looked a great financial collapse in the eye, and then they stopped it in its tracks. Actually, Dominique Strauss-Kahn was one of that handful of leaders. We're also quietly sitting in the second row is Don Cohn, who's also another one of those leaders. But this was just a handful of people, and they did what was a miracle. This miracle of policy sanity has so far saved us from a Great Depression. So the lesson here is if the financial system is about to collapse, we have no choice. We simply have to get all of us together as we did in the fall of 2008, in the spring of 2009, and we have to agree and we have to do what needs to be done. So for that, I made a little calculation. A small U.S.-based calculation indicates one of the logics behind that conclusion. Estimates of the cost of the United States Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, now have an upper bound of $50 billion. That's an upper bound. A second Great Depression, if we should have had it, at the minimum, would have given us 5 years of unemployment at 20% unemployment rates. Counting unemployment with TARP as being below 10%, which we now have, says that we got a reduction of at least 50 unemployment point years at a maximum cost of $50 billion. That is a cost of less than $1 billion per unemployment point year. In contrast, for fiscal stimulus packages, a rule of thumb for the United States, a rule of thumb is that it takes roughly $100 billion to reduce unemployment by one percentage point for 1 year. In terms of the effect on the deficit, financial rescue, when it is called for, is orders of magnitude more effective than stimulus. So there are reasons for this. There's a mathematical reason for that, and that is, so think about the fall of Lehman. The failure of the bankruptcy laws to take into account systemic risk results in a mathematical discontinuity. As soon as Lehman Brothers goes from $1 in the black to $1 in the red, there's an enormous change in the legal rules regarding financial transactions, and financial transactions totally freeze up. Expenditure of just the right $2 at exactly this point will make trillions of dollars of difference. Why? Because it saves the jobs on Main Street. That is the overriding reason why we need to prevent financial collapse. Popular wisdom now says that it only unfairly saves jobs on Wall Street, but that's wrong. So in closing, let me shift gears slightly. I'll give another analogy regarding the prevention of financial collapse. Usually, it would do great service to aim if we went to our neighbor's house and aimed high-pressure water hoses into through their windows and into their living rooms. But when a fire breaks out, that's exactly what the firemen do. They are brave men, and we thank them. I begin this point where I started. The IMF and all the Western governments must keep up the good work. We need a fire department. And then we should thank them for their continued valiant efforts, which have so far, they may have not have been 100% successful. We still have that diagram that we had at the end. But at least it wasn't much, 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 much worse. So thank you.
George, and now I turn to my good friend Stephen Percy, who you can do whatever you like. Either maybe you go there, it may be easier.
Maybe, okay. Yeah, maybe it's okay. I'll
yeah.
Well, after those three speeches, you're probably wondering what's left for me to say. I think you have a very clear and a very stark picture of the scale of the employment challenges, or the scale of the decent work challenges, not just any job, but decent jobs. And decent jobs clearly matter an awful lot to people. It's the heart of people's concern. I think George Akerlof explained how life is hell if you haven't got one. But is the search for ways to increase the availability of good jobs, is it at the heart of the employment or the economic policy dialogues that are going on nationally and globally? And despite the best efforts of the managing director of the fund, and the director general of the ILO, the general secretary of the ITUC, it isn't quite there. That's why I think the managing director was making the speech this morning, because we need to get it there. And I'd just like to offer three quick reflections on that policy challenge. First, on the role of broad-based policy dialogue. As Sharon remarked, the managing director has gone out of his way to open up the fund, and I would add the community of policy practitioners and theorists that surround the fund, to some new thinking. And today's exchange, I think, was a very good example of that. And the managing director and Sharon both referred to the conference with the ILO last September in Norway and the work that we're doing together. What it's doing, essentially, this effort of collaboration between the ILO and the International Monetary Fund, is to open up a policy dialogue between, if you like, the world of fiscal policy and finance, on the one hand, and the world of labor, of market, of the world of work on the other. And that is, it's refreshing, and it's very widely welcomed by, I think, both the ILO and the IMF's constituencies, precisely because both have to get to grips with this enormous challenge of creating enough work for people who need it. And we have a differentiated recovery, and the unemployment numbers look much worse in the industrial countries. But I think we need to remember that when we turn to the emerging economies, you still have a very rapidly growing labor force in those countries, and often very thin unemployment benefit systems. So you have to work. Even if you're struggling and hustling on the street corners, you have to find some work. And policy leaders, government leaders, trade union leaders, employers themselves in emerging countries are also worried about jobs. It's a slightly different way of expressing it, but it's still central to their concerns. So I think it is going to be a struggle to get this policy dialogue to really work, and not least because the reflexes of these two different communities and the language that they use is sometimes very different. But it's exactly the right thing to do, because the old intellectual verities that, you know, as the managing director was saying at the beginning of his speech, if you get enough growth, the jobs will come. It's not working anymore. We need to find some new ways forward. And another very important reason why we have to get to grips with it is because working people are hurting all over the world, and they need some credible answers from the policymakers as to how we're going to generate enough decent jobs for people to have decent lives. So I think policy dialogue is one of the reflections that I would draw from the three sets of remarks this morning. Secondly, coordination. And this is a favorite topic at the International Monetary Fund. I think the ILO also is working hard on it. And one thing to say is it's a lot easier said than done. The G20 technical experts are meeting this morning, and they're still struggling to get some very basic tools together to do the joint analysis that we need. But I don't want to speak this morning about the international policy coordination, which is a very big topic, but this need for coordination within countries. And the G20 dialogue has tended to focus on questions that finance ministers deal with, because the G20 was set up by finance ministers. It's generally driven by finance ministers still. And employment, as a result, is often treated as a residual. Exactly the problem that the managing director referred to. It's, you know, if we get everything right, it'll come along. And we need to escape from that. The idea is that if you get the fiscal balances back in kilter, if you deal with the debt overhang, the jobs will come. But the reality is that the scale of unemployment that we're facing, the difficulty of getting it down, is itself a barrier to getting the fiscal balances in order, is itself a barrier to getting the debt overhang dealt with. We need to deal with employment side by side with the other issues of macroeconomic policy. And I think one of the conclusions from that, it may be a very obvious one, but it has to be stated, employment is a macro policy issue. It's not something to be compartmentalized in a different place. But it isn't really at the macro table. Now, there are some countries that are ready to try and sort this out, including France, this year's G20 presidency. And I think the ILO and the fund can help them, and we're very ready to do so. But it is a very major challenge. And this brings me to my third point. Macro policymakers, including the fund, are beginning to focus much more on what is currently termed structural issues. And that includes labor markets. And for those of you who haven't come across it yet, structural is the current label for the way in which markets are organized, and thus whether they promote productivity and growth. One of the difficulties, I think, in looking at, if you like, the structural issues in labor markets is that labor markets are largely about people. And as events in North Africa have shown dramatically once again, but it's not just in North Africa, people care deeply about social justice, respect, and rights. And it's important to organize and work out how markets, labor markets in particular, can be efficient but promote equity too. I don't think it's enough to think about very clever systems of taxes and benefits which sort of fix the inequalities that come from the labour market after the event. I think we have to do that, certainly. But we also have to think about how we organise markets so that they're not so inequitable in the first place. And it was very encouraging to hear this morning the managing director talk about the centrality of collective bargaining. Again, I think a very important and neglected area of policy. But having said that we need to get to grips with this issue, and forgive me, managing director, but the fund has an implicit and sometimes explicit model of how people behave in the world of work, which, to my mind, bears little resemblance to the reality, even if it is conveniently computable. Again, cracking this policy challenge will require, in my view, the capacity of the fund and the ILO to convene policy practitioners. And when I use the phrase policy practitioners, I'm thinking of the trade unions, I'm thinking of the employers' organisations, I'm thinking of the labour ministries, as well as the finance ministries, and the theorists, the academics, the people who can give us the conceptual basis for this, to find a better way forward. And may I congratulate you, Kamal, on having George Akerlof join us this morning, because he's thinking about how to make models that do actually resemble the way in which people really behave, and ways in which we can have economic models that actually respect people's identity. So I congratulate Kamal and the Brookings Institute on this morning. I think it's an example of how we can open our minds to come up with some new thinking in this key area, and I'm very encouraged that we will eventually be able to deal with this, but it's going to be a heavy lift, and we need to have extensive collaboration to do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much, Stephen. Your last remarks remind me when I was reading Animal Spirits, the book of Professor Akerlof and Schiller. They recount in the beginning of the book how the great labor economist Al Rees, who was actually my professor at Princeton, towards the end of his life, said, well, some of the labor economics I taught weren't quite right. Let me start the discussion by asking all of the panelists, Dominique, Sharon, George, Stephen. Something has happened when we look at the last 60 years, or maybe even longer than 60 years, the period, the 30s, the Second World War was a special period. But after that, productivity started rising rapidly. But at the same time, in most countries, in the market economies, the gains of productivity were shared very widely. In fact, wages pretty much increased with productivity. And income distribution was fairly stable and had improved quite a bit in the 30s in the U.S. and in the Second World War, and continued to improve. And the middle class was strengthened, and in some ways, market economies had their golden age. And I think ultimately, they also prevailed worldwide over other systems, which may have had good intentions, but were quite ineffective in terms of economic results. But since roughly the 80s, productivity still is increasing, sometimes more rapidly, sometimes more slowly, but clearly the gains are no longer shared in the way they were before. And, I mean, the U.S. numbers are the ones I know best, and they're the best numbers in terms of the statistics. Just focusing on the top 1%, it's a dramatic story when the share of the top 1% goes from about 8% of national income to about 24% before the crisis. And the latest numbers we see during the crisis, you know, because of capital losses and things like that, there may have been a little bit of a diminution of that share. But the latest numbers we see, actually, is that productivity is again rising very rapidly. Profits are very high overall, and yet wages are stagnating in the U.S. and in many other countries. So probably the dynamics are continuing. And my question to start the discussion is, what happened, really, to the market economic system which so fundamentally changed the dynamics of income distribution?
Good question. I can have two tentative answers. The first one is that you're right in saying that there has been some equality fatigue. And where does it come from? The first answer I would try to give is that it's not really new. And when you look back to the beginning of the 19th century, not talking before, you have always have this kind of phase where society, especially the Western world at this time, more globally today, phases where the world is more interested in trying to organize collective action and work together and having a widespread of the gains and so on, and period where you have some backlash and you come to more, segmented society and the idea that too much has been done and going towards more inequalities. And so you have this movement backward. And clearly, at the beginning of the 80s, there has been this kind of political move. Some used to date this from the Proposition 13 in California, which was a kind of a beginning, even if it was a small event or itself, of trying to say, oh, enough is enough. So that's kind of, I think we have waves like this. The question is that certainly now we must be at the beginning of a new wave, which is a wave of taking more into account the need to fight against this different kind of income inequality, inequality in unemployment between the young and others and so on. But there's another thing, which is more recent, which is globalization. And what means globalization in the labor market? Means that rather suddenly, you have the millions of people coming in the labor market, in the global labor market, with the countries providing this supply of people, not providing the same amount of capital because they were not as developed. So supply and demand worked. More supply on the labor market, less supply proportionally on the capital market, the price of capital rises, the price of labor decreases. So, of course, then you may say, fine, but then all prices of labor should decrease, and why inequality among the people? Because part of them, the rewards of part of them are still linked to the capital rewards and the financial activity. So while the period of trade globalization has been associated with decreasing inequalities, financial globalization has been associated with increasing inequality because of this incredible change on the labor market. Practically, it means, as we all know, work in some developing countries at very low cost, competing with what may exist in advanced economy and so on. So this is a more recent event, but I think it plays its part, not only the cyclical way that society move for more individualistic to more collective society, but also this event, which is not totally new because part of the cyclical historical event comes also from the previous phase of globalization, which had the same effect. And this phase of globalization brings the same kind of result.
Thank you, Dominic. Sharon,
how
do you see it?
I think Dominic's given you the frame. Let me make 3 points. If you actually take that period at the beginning of the 20th century where you had the 20s, 30s, 40s, perhaps 50s in some developed countries, then the social contracts that were made with citizens around social protection, particularly unemployment benefits, pensions and so on, were a result of social unrest. The Great Depression, World War II, and in fact our societies in the developed world built social protection systems when they were poor. It was a social contract, but it didn't just work to support the dignity of people, it actually worked to provide an economic stabiliser, which has only been recognised in economic policy at the margins. And, of course, it carries a lot of tension because people don't think that we should be about social justice. Well, we think it should be about social justice and solidarity with people who are more vulnerable. But economically, we have to be about those issues, as we've said today. The second thing is that capital got too greedy. In the world that I grew up in, at least in Australia, if you go back to the middle of last century through to about the 80s, then the companies, the big companies in particular, settled for a rate of return around 6-7%. It was a long-term strategic return to capital. And, of course, it was mirrored by the strength of labour market institutions, minimum wages, collective bargaining, that actually distributed more equitably the wealth of the nation. So I think the Prime Minister of Norway made this point a few years ago, that you grew collectively more wealthy and it had its own cycle, you know, virtual cycle of growth and stability. Here in the US, when you look at the fact that collective bargaining rates had fallen to 7% or so in the private sector, the minimum wage didn't increase for God knows how many years because it's in the hands of politicians rather than any economic analysis of a wage on which you can live, then it's not rocket science to see that inequity is going to grow. And the third piece is really around the question of globalisation. And I think the imbalances between trade liberalisation without strong labour market institutions and the economic tools of social protection, minimum wages and collective bargaining, those rights that we talk about all the time that are so valuable to any stability frame in a country, were not there. Were simply not there. And people, we fought ideologically over these things and we've got to get beyond it. We really have to get beyond it and say, what in this world that requires people to be cohesive around both economic and social policy requires us to step back and start to find, you know, the common ambitions for our kids and grandkids across the divide and therefore to build an economic and a social future. So I think Dominic's frame's right, but for us there are particular points. And one last thing I'd say is that you can turn this around. I think productivity is growing, but frankly it's only growing with any stability in the emerging economies. What we've seen to date is low wage productivity based on the globalisation factors Dominic talked about, and that can't be sustained. We're interested in productivity, but we know the drivers of productivity are much more significant. They're innovation, skills, technology, work organisation, supply chain cohesion, a whole range of factors that we want to be part of a new conversation around globally. My country, we did this in the early 90s. We built both a restructuring of the economy, but on skills-based productivity, we also generated skills-based wages and career rewards, and it served us well. At the same time, we built, of course, a much stronger social security system, including the pension funds that are deferred wages by bargaining that held Australia up in terms of savings during both the Asian crisis and now this.
Thank you, Sharon. George, you want to add?
Just briefly. So I think the economic work initially, they claimed it was all due to technical change, so-called skilled bias technical change. Very nice paper by Thomas Lemieux, which says it isn't skill bias technical change. It is changes in minimum wages and it is changes in unionization, which exactly follows what Sharon was saying. Just one note. I think that another thing that could account for this change in the income distribution is the increased power of lobbying and changes in the detail regarding the financial laws and what powers that gives people.
Thank you. Stephen?
Yeah, I think that we're on the right track here. I think there's two things going on. I think one is this first one, if you like, of much more open markets, global markets, it's not so much the opening of the markets, it's the consequence. It's the fact you have much intensified competition. Competition from abroad, not just in your own market, coupled with a profound structural transformation caused by the technological changes that have been going on for the past 20 years or so. So the consequence of that, I think, is that those who are able to compete at somewhere near the global technological frontier, whether they be in South Africa or China or the United States, are doing quite well. But most people are not in those occupations. Most people are employed in the service sector and relatively small employers in the service sector. And they're not doing so well. You know, the fastest growing occupation in the world is street trading. You know, it's hustling. It's making do because you haven't got anything better. So that clearly is an important aspect. But I would very much agree with what George just said, and that is that the policy has sort of been going in the opposite direction just when you needed it most. That we've been weakening minimum wages legislation in many countries. Trade unions have been hard-pressed to maintain the coverage of collective bargaining because the commanding heights have shifted. It's very hard to organise lots of smaller service sector employers. And at the same time, the tax and benefit system has been shifting in the wrong direction. And finally, and perhaps the most worrying element of it, is we're now getting into the sort of second round effects, and that is that we see signs of social mobility reducing. You know, the U.S. Has less social mobility than the so-called rigid European countries these days. How's that happening? Most likely because the wealthier people can afford to send their children to the best schools where they get the best education and the best jobs. And if you can't, you're hustling and struggling. So I think we're into the... when it's not just a matter of our income inequality, it's also a matter of opportunities, because social mobility is beginning to stagnate.
Absolutely.
Very good point. Well, Sharon said one thing, which I just want to add maybe one point, and that is the kind of expectation about the rate of profit. You know, in fundamental growth theory, there is a relationship between the real growth of the economy, the rate of profit, and the share of profits. Mm-hmm. And unless the share of profits keeps going up, the rate of return on capital, you know, has to be close to the rate of growth of the economy. But somehow in the financial sector, the culture has grown where, you know, anything below, I don't know, 10, 12, 15%, 20, 23%, is considered no good.
Yeah, exactly.
And the real economy in the advanced countries, at least, you know, the potential growth rate, I mean, 3-4% perhaps. So there is a fundamental problem here between kind of expectations coming from the financial sector and what's really healthy, sustainable in terms of real return on capital. I think that's a good point. So let's open the discussion. We'll take some questions from the floor. We'll take a few questions so that we can group them 2-3, and then we'll turn. Yes. Please do identify yourselves kindly.
My name is Judd Herriot. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I have a nuts and bolts kind of a question for Managing Director Khan. Excuse me. If as a result of your surveillance, annual surveillance, so let's say country X, you determine that equity and income distribution is a serious problem, constraining growth, and country X enters into a medium-term facility with the fund, does that mean that income distribution, equity, and employment are going to be explicit targets in such things? Is that how you're going to design your future programs?
All right. There were questions in the back. Two questions in the back, yeah.
Thank you. Garth Trinkle, Department of Commerce. A question for Dr. Akerlof. Professor Rajan, in his third fault, in Fault Lines, talks about the U.S. need for a new system of unemployment insurance and social protection. Could you talk about your response to that, and how would you take your animal spirits analysis and combine that with Rajan's third fault and perhaps Mrs. Burrow's point about developments in Australia in the last 10 years to talk about what policy the U.S. might propose going forward for the next 6 years? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, we can take one or two more.
Thank you. My name is Werner Puschra. I'm representing the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, which is a German foundation, and I'm representing the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung in New York. So I find this focus on employment and inequality in the debate very important and very necessary, given the recent experiences during and after the financial crisis. But I want to emphasize is that it is also necessary to look at the quality of employment, not just employment as such. And in order to underline this argument, I want to look at the German experiences, which I know best. I mean, when you look at German statistics, yeah, growth is relatively high, unemployment has decreased, is relatively low, and employment has reached historical high levels, namely more than 40 million people are employed in Germany now. But what is the price of it? The price is that more than 10 million, meaning 25% of those employed, are having precarious jobs, jobs which are not sufficient to sustain themselves and their families. Yeah? So inequalities are still growing despite Germany being a high productivity country. So even those people having employment, yeah, feel like living in hell because they cannot make ends meet. This is from the German perspective, but it also has effects on the European Union and the other countries in Europe. So because, let's say, low German wages and these high productivity, low wages policies create additional economic and social pressures on other countries in Europe, like Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and so on, which even makes the IMF recommend to those countries, you have to lower your wages and freeze wages, because German competitiveness is much too high for you to be able to create additional growth which is needed to get out of the crisis. So my question is, there's a lot wrong in this whole system, in this whole setup. What are the policies which need to be undertaken to change this general picture, labor market, macroeconomic policies, and how can those policies be better coordinated within the European Union and, of course, on global level?
Thank you. Here, yes?
John Evans from the Trade Union Advisory Committee to the OECD. Managing Director, I think if your speech was sort of condensed into the conclusions of the spring meetings this week, and that was the outcome of these meetings, I think many of us would have felt we'd died and gone to heaven in terms of these issues. But building on that last question, I mean, in the European debate at the moment, the focus is almost entirely on fiscal consolidation, austerity measures, and almost locking Europe into a period of probably what many of us fear will be sustained low growth on the fiscal side. And yet the policy then comes back to argue for structural reforms, many of which look exactly like the sort of measures which increased inequality in the past that George Akerlof referred to, pressure on minimum wages, decentralization of collective bargaining, limitation of the duration of unemployment benefits, employment protection legislation, which looks very much like the US model, which led to the crisis in the first place, not the sort of European models which have been rather successful. So what is your assessment of the hope of getting, as you said at the end of your speech, a different approach in the policy conclusions of some of the key finance ministries as a result of these meetings in the next few days?
All right, we'll take one more here, and then we'll turn to the panel.
Thank you. Malcolm Lovell, Brookings Advisory Council. In a competitive world, and we're becoming a more competitive world every day, education is a very, very important quality in our race to be competitive. And American public education, in my judgment, is not keeping up with the demands of the workforce. I'd like your comments on that.
All right. Let's turn to the panel. Dominique, why don't we start with you?
Yeah. Two points I would like to comment. The first question on what about the design of our future programs, and the second one about the question was shared between the two gentlemen here on what kind of policy we may advise. On the first point, what I say is that for sustainability of growth reasons, we need to take more into account than we did in the past. All the question going around income inequalities and all that stuff. But I don't believe I'm going to turn the IMF into an institution with a lot of experts on this question, because it's not our job. So first thing is that we need to rely on the job which is done by others, the World Bank, many organizations, trade unions, NGOs, academia, to give us the information, because in no way we can build this inside the IMF. Relying on this, we will have a better view on the forecast we may make for a country. And then how does it interfere when a country is likely to come to the IMF and ask for some support? Well, I won't say that I see this kind of topics becoming defined targets for IMF program, because first, it's very difficult to measure, so it's open to a lot of controversy. Second, we have to deal with short-term problems, and to go put country back on track on short-term. And income inequality, for instance, are a long-term question. So the changes that may happen during 1 year or 2 year program are really not significant enough. But It doesn't mean that if it's not doesn't become really a target of the program, it's not taken into account of the program. Let me give you two examples. When we have program both in the first waiver program in the European Union or Latvia, Hungary, or in the rest of the world, let's think about Pakistan, when we try to put in place new element in the program that we call social conditionality, which is to take care of what happens to the most vulnerable during the time frame of the program, it goes in this direction, which is to take care that the program will not have, or at least as possible, consequences on the most vulnerable. So it's taking this into account. Second example, when we built the Greek program, the question of what's going to happen on wages was, of course, one of the questions, and I will address this point more directly with the second question. And I had a discussion with Juan Somavia, the head of the ILO at this time, and his advice was, you better let, on the public sector, you do what you have to do because they're really at the edge of the cliff. But on the private sector, my advice, he said, would be to let the collective bargaining go on and the private sector deal with the government and see what they can do, because it's the only way to protect minimum of fairness and distribution of in the distribution of income. What we did. And so, contrarily to what many have in mind, in the Greek program, there's no comment from the IMF on private wages, just to say, okay, we'll let this to the social partners to discuss it together. So that's two examples which are not putting in place explicit target on this topic, but taking this into account in the building of the programs. Now to the second point. The problem is the contradiction between short-term and long-term. Some countries are in such a difficult situation that they need short-term action expeditiously. That's the fire department George was talking about. And when the house is burning and you ask the firefighter to come, well, the problem is not how much water they will put in the house. After, you will have to mop up, of course, and that's a problem. But the problem, it's the one you accept because you want to avoid fire. So back to our problem. In some countries, especially in the European Union or in the Eurozone, where the fiscal situation is so deteriorated that the first thing to do is to fix this, we have to fix this. If not, it will collapse, and growth will collapse, and then the consequences in terms of wages, income, and so on will be 10 times as big. So we need absolutely to fix it. I'm not saying that to fix it can be done without a cost, and there is a cost. The problem is how to have this cost shared in a fair way, and back to my first point. But it has to be done. Let me give you just an example without name of countries. In public sector wages, since the beginning of the euro, in the eurozone, the average increase is 38%. And most countries are ranging between 30 and 45, more or less. One country, you will easily find which, had an increase of only 20%. So this country had some gain of competitiveness, clearly, which is a problem that has been addressed or raised by the gentleman. But some other countries, not so many, let's say three, had an increase of 100%. Of course, if it was in line with productivity, no problem. But obviously it doesn't reflect totally. I don't say it doesn't reflect at all. It doesn't reflect totally change in productivity. So you have a problem. And there's no surprise that you have at the end a fiscal problem. I'm talking about wages in the public sector. So you need to fix it. But you're absolutely right that we have to do it having in mind how we restore growth. And our main fight, I think it's public, so I'm not revealing any kind of secret. Our main discussion, not fight, but discussion with our friends from the European institution, is that, they're more Catholic than the Pope. And putting all the stress on the fiscal. And we say, cool down. Fiscal has to be fixed, but growth has to be supported, and we try to push them to have enhancing growth measures that, of course, they're not against, but it's not their first way to look at the problem. Second part of my answer, and I've been too long, sorry, is that structural reforms, very often, you're absolutely right, refers to a traditional way to look at the labor market and so on. But there are many other structural reform that has to be put in place. And when we say structural reform, it's not only, far from that, the labor market. Fixing, repairing, and reforming the banking sector is part of the structural reform. And as George Fire very nicely said, there's no way for a strong recovery and a fair recovery, not only in the European countries, but especially in the European countries, without fixing this problem, which is still not fixed. And so this kind of reform is also a structural reform, which has nothing to do with the traditional structural reform you had in mind.
Thank you. Sharon?
Well, three quick responses. First of all, employment and social protection have to be targets for all governments. If they're not, and they're not worked out with the society about how and how long, then in fact social unrest will grow, and ultimately employers have to accept that, or their businesses are at risk in the medium term. In terms of the FES, quality employment, absolutely. Let me just give you a bit of a challenge for the German economy. They continue to resist a minimum wage. I have no idea why, because economically, if you have a look at it, the figures, I think, from 2010 showed that if you had a minimum wage of 7.5 euros an hour, then, in fact, scaling up to 9 in 2011, then you would improve the income of 4 million full-time employees and 5 million part-time workers, but you would create 225,000 jobs in the short term, 600,000 in the medium term. That's got to be a big boost to demand and to employment. And then, of course, if you go to somewhere like Zambia, where we're working, where the economy is 80 to 90% in the informal sector, and you talk about decent work, then a minimum wage and indeed social protection underpinning it would start, in fact, to destroy the 80% informal economy and build sustainable development. On fiscal consolidation, I think it was Dominic who said to us in a conversation that it appears that the Washington consensus has moved from Washington to Brussels, and we're very worried about the thinking going on in the European context. We're not opposed to fiscal consolidation, but it's like any family budget. You do it over time based on a recipe around growth, and that's got to be job and income centred. And we want to talk about that based on real productivity, not the crazy kind of superficial return to ideology that's going on in Europe right now. But I would say you can't just have competitiveness based on wages. It's a never-ending story of decline. You must have genuine productivity, and therefore competitiveness is a much more sophisticated story around value-added industries and services and global integration than it is around that, and than it is around just wages. And finally, in terms of skills and education, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not just a teacher by trade. I've actually, I only resigned from my job, my part-time job as a member of the Australian Skills Council when I took up this job last year. We had estimated for the Australian economy, if we didn't increase education and training, but vocational education training I'm talking about now, it goes without saying we've got to invest in basic education, by a third, in a small economy with a workforce of 10 million, we weren't going to make the grade on competitiveness and indeed or meet our own skills deficit despite an unemployment gap in a two-speed economy. And we certainly weren't going to have the skills to invest in the green economy that would grow jobs by up to a million in a 10 million workforce over 15 to 20 years if the investment frame was set. So anybody who's not thinking about skills in the mix of productivity and competitiveness is frankly going to lose out in the longer term.
George, I think the one question was particularly addressed to you.
Okay, I'll answer that very briefly. There's currently a myth that things like extension of unemployment benefits is going to create bad disincentives, which is going to reduce the number of people employed. That's when you look at Mount Everest, and you know that there are more than 4 million people in the labor market who are searching for jobs for more than 26 weeks. If you apply for a job, there's going to be 250 other people applying for that job. Those disincentive effects can zero effects on unemployment. So there are no disincentive. There can be almost no disincentive effects whatsoever.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take maybe two or three more questions, and then we'll have to round up. Yes, I'm glad we have.
Yes, good morning, Sunjin Choi, Langham Partners. Mr. Shostak, could I follow your comment on unemployment and inequality in MENA region? And according to ILO statistics, an unemployment rate under age 15 to 25 to 25%. However, other surveys indicate 35%. But when you look at MENA region A, their employment largely public sector job. Egypt, Jordan, Syria, one-third is jobs coming from public sector. And B is largely rent-sector economy. And C, poor governance institutions and poor governance create huge problem. My question is, how do you coordinate with World Bank, A, and B? What is your view and pro and cons creating a regional development bank in MENA region? Thank you.
Mauricio?
Thank you. Mauricio Cardenas from Brookings. I want to come back to the question that was raised by Kemal at the beginning, because I think if we don't get the answer right to that question, it's very difficult to make recommendations ahead. So why is it that productivity gains have not been shared by everyone? I have the impression that we live in a world that is very different today from what we learn in the textbooks. In the textbooks, we learned that labor was a non-tradable good. And I think globalization has made labor much more tradable. So with the framework that we used to have, we thought about labor policies in the nation spectrum, increasing the minimum wages, benefits, collective bargaining, et cetera. And I think if we apply those measures at the national level, we're going to do more harm than good, because we're ignoring the fact that that labor that there is a large global supply of labor. Let me illustrate this with an example. I'm from Colombia. Every year, at the end of the year, we have to negotiate and discuss the minimum wage. And of course, everyone wants a higher minimum wage. But the economists, us, we have to bring to the conversation, look at China. We're competing with China, and we have to bring to the conversation also protectionism in countries like the U.S. So if we apply those policies based on the old framework that, again, are national in spirit, I think we're going to do harm more than good.
Okay, we have quite a few questions, but the time is running, so we can't overrun. I will take one question here, and then I think we'll have to close. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Andrew Watt, and I work at the European Trade Union Institute in Brussels, a city which is being disparaged here quite rightly, in my view. quick remark on employment and one on inequality. Employment remark is a number of the panelists mentioned the link between growth and employment and said that was problematic, and I certainly agree with that on job quality and other issues. Having said that, I mean, 80% of the job losses in Europe in the recession can simply be explained by the size of the output loss. So, and the reason we're not bringing unemployment down is that simply growth is too weak, certainly in Europe and the US. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. It's not just a Brussels problem, it's also a Frankfurt problem. We now have the ECB raising interest rates in Europe for reasons that I fail to understand. On inequality, very briefly, it may be worth pointing out that a number of countries have actually prevented through policies a rise in inequality. I would mention France, the home country of Mr. Choskan, which has managed that for reasons I'm not really qualified to comment on. And the others until recently are the Nordic countries. And the Nordic countries managed that quite successfully until they moved away from their social democratic model in recent years and allowed right-wing governments to introduce more traditional liberal policies which have now led to a rise in inequality in those countries.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this, in a way, can be taken together with Mauricio's question. I mean, Mauricio says that in an open economy, there, you know, you can't do the same things necessarily than in a closed economy. But on the other hand, it is true that within the globalized economy, different countries have achieved quite different results, despite the common features of globalization. So I think, one has to think about that. We're going to take let me add one more thing myself, and then we'll take both the final round of points and answers to the questions, and we'll go in the reverse order, starting with Stephen. But one question, you know, Brussels, I mean, despite the fact that Turkey still doesn't manage to enter the European Union, I still have a strong sympathy for the European Union, and in the defense of Brussels, maybe. Do you think it has something to do with the fact that the U.S., you know, is the major global reserve currency issuer and therefore kind of worries less in terms of its currency and so on, whereas the euro is kind of struggling as a currency because of the divergences and the problems we've had. And so in some sense, there's a European reflex that is kind of linked to the euro and the fact that in that sense, they're in a quite different position from the U.S. Just a question. Stephen.
Thanks. I think what I'd like to pick up is some of these discussions about, how much international coordination can you do around labour market employment policy issues. And clearly, if you're arguing, as I was arguing just now, that employment and labour market policies are macro policies, and it's increasingly important in an open global economy to coordinate your macro policies, then you're arguing that you should coordinate your employment and labour market policies to a degree internationally. And I think, coming from the ILO, that's not hard to argue, since it's written into the 1919 Constitution that the only way you can make social progress in one country is if other countries are moving forward together. And the logic of the ILO's system of international labour standards is precisely that. It's to gradually build up floors of agreed commitments and standards as to how you run your employment and labour markets. And I would say on minimum wages, the logic there is that the ILO doesn't say what the minimum wage should be, but it does lay out some good principles as to how you go about fixing it. And large numbers of countries are ratifying that, and even those that aren't ratifying it are going to use it as a way of setting up their systems, including China. So I think the question that started this one off was, is the IMF going to get involved in surveillance of these issues? Is it going to be starting to tell countries how to distribute their income, to put it very crudely? And the managing director said, no, others can do that. I think we do have to find ways to do it. And it's interesting that the G20, when it started to look at how to do macroeconomic policy coordination, came up with the phrase mutual assessment process. It didn't want to use the phrase surveillance. And that was the idea that you can, by peer discussions between yourselves, you can find a way forward. And I think that is likely to be it. Because almost inevitably, we are getting into discussions about what's the right collective bargaining system in a country. Should it be centralized? Should it be industrial level? Should it be decentralized? We're getting into international discussions about what the right laws are to have on hiring and firing. And I think there are many answers to what the right laws on collective bargaining are, or the right laws and practices on hiring and firing. But in the end, you do have to have systems that enable people to change jobs smoothly and quickly, find better jobs quickly, the points that George Akerlof has been making. And you do need to have systems of bargaining that mean that wages move ahead with productivity and don't get way ahead of the unit labour costs of other countries. There are lots of different ways to solve that. And I think the loose, if you like, frameworks that the ILO offers is a good starting point.
George?
Let me just add one point that Derby already made, that the United States could potentially be Canada, that somehow we were much closer to Canada if you go back 30 years ago. And that is largely a result of our policies.
Sharon?
Well, in terms of unemployment and young people, I think this is the social divide that is going to actually destroy social harmony everywhere if we don't get it right. We have a responsibility to intergenerational wealth and equity, and if we don't focus on it, then the very issues we're talking about now, the vulnerabilities, just become gaping holes. Can I say that's why we called for a youth unemployment pact that the G20 should focus on? It crosses the partnership between skills, education, and indeed employment. And just let me give you an example of the challenge I've put to the employers in France and now Spain, but soon to be Germany and Brazil. There are 1,200 French companies in Tunisia. There are, I think from memory, 400 or 500 Spanish companies. There's a lot of Italian companies, Germany and Belgium likewise. If they went back to old, tried and true notions and the global ODA environment supported them, if we took an apprentice in even a half of those countries out of Tunisia and an intern in the public sector, including some global solidarity about interns in other countries in the short term and a wage subsidy scheme from ODA, guess what? You would absolutely settle with the social protection base that's already there, the unrest that exists there for good reason. So public sector hasn't got to ease up on its support for employment, but the private sector has to do its bit. There's a lot of things we can do in the medium term, but right now we need a short-term solution, and we think we've got some ideas. Can I say, I'd love to have a long debate. I do not agree with you at all about the role of minimum wages. Look to China. Spend as much time talking to China as we do. And you know they're looking for a rising wage solution. They're not about a low-wage future. And they know that that's going to take them a long trajectory, but that's where their heads are, both with social protection and wages. And their wages, given the strikes in Foxconn and other places last year, are escalating by amounts that we couldn't contemplate in the rest of the world, but their growth rates allow it. And frankly, our Western countries are your problem around inequity and competitiveness, because they want to drive low-wage cultures in their own interests of that rising profit obscenity. So let's get the story straight. And I've heard this for 30 years. Forgive me for being a little provocative about it, but in my own country, every year on the minimum wage question, we said, this will kill jobs, this will kill jobs. Well, guess what? It hasn't. It's actually grown our economy. It's stabilised our economy. And I think if you look at Brazil as well as China, right next door to Colombia, get some answers about emerging economies, wages and social protection and the growth equation that you need. So for us, jobs, jobs and jobs, that's the answer, underpinned by social protection and, of course, those wealth distribution tools. If we don't have global coordination and local support, then the imbalances that exist today are simply going to grow and nobody benefits. The EU is a great place to have a look at what not to do. And when you have conversations with emerging leaders, President Zuma last week in South Africa, some of the ministers yesterday in Spain, then you know that the conversation is about whether Europe is going to be part of the future or where emerging economies are actually going to start to dominate the environment around policy setting. And it's a really interesting challenge for us. The EU has to look to a growth model, and it has to look to being part of that future. If we're to see that those imbalances are restructured, we need the coordination and the solidarity between nations, not just within nations. Finally, can I say that on the jobs front, if you don't look to domestic demand, if you don't look to wages, and you don't build domestic economies, then not, you know, this nonsense that every country can be an export, have an export-led recovery, who's going to pay? Who's going to buy the goods? Workers. So let's get the recipe right for jobs, for fair wages, and indeed for social protection. We'll build domestic economies, and then we'll play into a much fairer global economic frame.
Thank you, Sharon. Dominique, last words.
Well, no, just a few words. First about the question in MENA. Part of the answer has to do with the demographic. And clearly, this part of the world is not the only part of the world, but it's a part of the world where the increase has been very strong, and so the young people are really a large part of the population. I made, in November, in Morocco, in a conference which was on human development, growth, and so on, there's this point that demographic was clearly a time bomb for North African countries. I'm not pretending it was a visionary. I mean, it's common knowledge, but it was just 2 months before all the troubles, and it's clear that they have a big problem. Not because demographic by itself, it's a strength for a country, but when it's not managed to provide education in the right way to the increasing number of people, and for many reasons hasn't been done, even in oil-producing countries having the resources to do it, then it leads to the situation that we have seen. On the short term, we're ready to help in the Middle East. We're going to see the evolution of the situation in the coming weeks, but we're ready to help. We already have some discussion with some countries, and of course they will have short-term problems to solve. On the Brussels question, yeah, you're right. The U.S. have a currency having a playing a special role, and that gives the U.S. some situation, some possibility to deal differently than the others with their own deficit. That's true. Is that good? Is that bad? That's another discussion, but that's a fact. And so certainly the Europeans, they may be upset by this, but that's the reality, are not so far, and I don't think it will happen anytime soon, in a situation of the United States facing the rest of the world. That doesn't mean that emerging market, emerging market are contributing for a large part of global growth today. That's absolutely true. But an interesting thing is to resize the map of the world according to GDP, financial assets, trade, and so on. And then you see that this old-fashioned Europe is still a large part of the global economy. Certainly, growth doesn't come from there. They have a lot of problems to solve, which is, I'm the first to say that and to criticize them. But it's going a bit too fast to believe that in the coming decade, the global growth will only rely on what happens in emerging economies. Now, they're overheating. It's the case in Asia, it's the case in Latin America. They will have to deal with this overheating problem, and they're facing the traditional problem of needing to have a less accommodative monetary policy and a more tightening fiscal policy as others. So they have been they have benefited from very nice years, and that's very good, and they use it to lift out of poverty millions of people. Very well done. Now we enter in a phase of the history where even emerging countries are going to face the same kind of sustainability problem that the advanced economy know.
Well, thank you very much. I want to say that, you know, we've had two top international global leaders here, Dominique and Sharon. We've had a Nobel Prize-winning economist. We've had Stephen Percy, who top at the ILO and devoted his life to labor issues. And we haven't had an institutional bureaucratic discussion, I think. We've had a real substantive exchange, open exchange on real issues that faces the world. So please join me in thanking our panelists for coming here and for sharing their views with us. Thank you.